You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next hour, we'll be shedding some light on one of Africa's least reported crises, talking to Monocle's Tristan McConnell, just back from the Nuba Mountains in Sudan. We'll also be talking to London's Mayor, Boris Johnson, about the city's newest landmark, The Orbit.
It's a statement of economic confidence in London, in the Stratford site. It's our way of saying that London is welcoming the world, it's beckoning the world to London in 2012 for the summer, but it's also even more important.
An archaeologist has just discovered an ancient language in the ruins of a 2,800-year-old Assyrian palace. He'll join us live to talk through his findings. And we'll hear what happens when you unintentionally become the mayor of your small Italian village. All that, plus a chat with one of our neighbours, a catch-up with one of our editors, and maybe one or two songs, right here on Midori House. But before we get started with any of that, here's Nick Kelly with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Greek President Karolos Papoulias received the outgoing Prime Minister Loukas Papademos today in his presidential palace for an urgent briefing on the state of the country. The leaders of Greece's once dominant conservative and socialist parties have made a push to avert new elections and prevent a victory by a radical leftist who has promised to tear up its international bailout deal. The majority of Greeks want to stay in the Eurozone, but voted last Sunday for parties that reject the severe terms of the bailout negotiated with the European Union and the International Monetary Fund. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde warned Greece that it must form a government in the coming weeks.
Well, I'll be very brief to your question. Is it important to have a government in the coming weeks? Of course it is important. Not only from the perspective of implementing a programme, but in all respects.
The brother of one of the victims of the Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik threw a shoe at him in court today. It's the first time the trial has been interrupted by a public outburst. The shoe missed Breivik but struck his co-defence lawyer. The shoe thrower was removed by police and police numbers were boosted in the court after the incident. Activists have said Syrian government forces fired on anti-regime protesters in Damascus today. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that five civilians were wounded. Thousands of people were protesting across Syria a day after two bomb attacks struck the capital, killing 55 people. The European Union's foreign policy chief said today she hoped upcoming talks with Iran would form the basis for Tehran to eventually abandon its alleged nuclear weapons project. Speaking ahead of talks scheduled for May the 23rd in Baghdad, Catherine Ashton, who's been representing the major powers at talks about Iran's nuclear activity, said she had high hopes for the new round of negotiations.
My ambition is that we come away with the beginnings of the end, if you like, of the nuclear weapons programme of Iran.
Médecins Sans Frontières has decried a lack of action by Nigeria's government to tackle a lead poisoning epidemic that has killed 400 children and poisoned 10 times as many near a gold mine. Ministers of Mines, Environment and Health were scheduled to attend a two-day conference on the lead poisoning in northern Nigeria's remote Zamfara state organised by MSF ending yesterday, but none of them showed up. Ivan Gayton, Médecins Frontières representative in Nigeria, expressed the need for urgent measures to be taken by Nigeria's government to provide relevant assistance.
There are 1,500 more children in a village called Bagega who are still living in contaminated circumstances. We cannot treat them. They're suffering, they're dying, and there's nothing we can do because if they're not living in clean circumstances, we can't help them with medical treatment. Medical treatment is ineffective.
And in Britain, Rebecca Brooks, former editor of the News of the World newspaper, has told an inquiry that Prime Minister David Cameron was among top British politicians who sent her sympathetic messages when she was forced to resign. The newspaper was closed last July when it emerged its journalists had hacked into the voicemail of public figures and a murdered schoolgirl. Brooks admitted receiving messages when questioned by lawyer Robert Jay at the Leveson inquiry.
Occasionally he would sign them off, LOL, lots of love. Actually, until I told him it meant laugh out loud, and then he didn't sign them like that anymore. But, I mean, in the main DC, I would have thought. Mm.
Rebecca Brooks at the Leveson Inquiry, and those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's 18.05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 target, yeah.
Monocle 24, you're also.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24. The
Bropa Jalabert. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
The Nuba Mountains, an incongruously beautiful range of rugged peaks and desiccated savanna, lie in the heart of one of Sudan's most volatile yet unreported regions. Across a lunar landscape and under the hot sun of the Sahel, a rebellion has been taking place, one that has been brutally suppressed by Omar al-Bashir's government in Khartoum. With aid blocked and bombs dropped, Sudan's government has brought the Nuba Mountains in the country's South Kordofan region to the brink of famine. The rebellion in South Kordofan has long been flagged as a new Darfur, yet reporting on the crisis has become increasingly treacherous. One of those journalists who managed to make his way in was Tristan McConnell, Monocle's Nairobi correspondent. He returned to Nairobi last week and he joins us on the line from the Kenyan capital now. Tristan, welcome to Midori House. Before we talk about your journey into the Nuba Mountains, perhaps you could give us a quick sort of potted history of the conflict there.
You mentioned the new Darfur as a tagline for this, and that's a pretty good way of looking at it. Essentially, what we're seeing in the Nuba Mountains is something that we've seen across al-Bashir's Sudan for decades, really, which is a fight between, you know, the powerful centre versus the marginalised peripheries. And this time, you know, this iteration of it is happening in the Nuba Mountains. So we have a marginalised people, a mixture of mostly African, some Arab, but a mixture of religions, living in an area, and they feel they're not getting a fair share of the national pie. They don't have fair representation in government or anything like that. They're marginalised economically as well as politically, and they're fighting for their rights. And Bashir doesn't like that. So just as we saw in Darfur, we're seeing in New Mountains, which is, you know, a military assault on a rebel army and the civilians who surround them.
And just like in Darfur, certainly the early stages of Darfur, it's not an easy conflict for journalists to cover to get the story out. Can you explain a little bit about how you went about getting in?
Sure. I mean, without getting any of my contacts into trouble, I mean, the simple explanation, I met up with some of the SPLA North rebels in South Sudan, and I travelled with them, essentially sort of smuggled across the border into the Nuba Mountains. And they looked after us. We stayed with them. We drove around with them for a few days in the Nuba Mountains. And, you know, every day there were jet fighters and bombers flying overhead. There was ground fighting going on, not that we went too close to it. But to me, it wasn't so much the military aspect that was striking. It was the human and social aspect. And that was really quite shocking. I mean, I met many people who were living in caves in the hills to take shelter from these constant bombing runs that were coming every day. And because they're living in the mountains like that, they're not able to plant their crops. So they missed the planting season last year when the conflict broke out in June. They're about to miss this one. And something I'd never seen before is, you know, whole families living in caves eating leaves for their food because there's nothing else left. And that was a really horrendous sight. And it's hard to believe that, you know, they can really hold out much longer.
And this is a region where, you know, although not necessarily rich before, you know, people that were living there maybe say, you know, 3 or 4 years ago before this conflict began, had a certain quality of life that was possible to get food. There were schools, there were some sort of structures there, no?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, there were schools, there were busy, packed markets, there was a lot of trade, both coming down from the north and also up from the south. And these guys are, you know, really hard-working farmers. You know, they grow sorghum is the staple, they also grow maize, they grow beans and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So they're not sort of, you know, they know how to farm. This is their land. And they're prevented from doing that by the bombing, and perhaps more importantly, the fear of bombing. You know, I saw this with my own eyes. You know, whenever you hear an aeroplane, you know, the children fall silent and cower in the corner. The adults run. You know, people are terrified of the noise of the Antonov, which comes overhead. And when there's actually a bombing run that's happened on my final day there, I mean, you know, the explosion goes and everyone hits the ground. And you can just, you can really see the fear in their eyes. And more than that, you know, you can feel it off when you're there. And that was, that again was very striking.
Talk to us a bit about the difficulties as a journalist when you are trying to cover a story like this. And obviously you have to be balanced, you have to get the story right, but you are in the pocket, so to speak, not literally, but you know, you are, you know, right alongside a rebel group who some would say are one of the protagonists in this conflict.
Sure.
How tricky does that make it?
It does make it difficult, but I think you just have to be honest in your reporting. I mean, there are a couple of things here. One is that, you know, I've applied numerous times for a visa for Khartoum in order to, you know, go there and kind of get that side of the story, and it's been refused every time. So, you know, they're not allowing me to tell their side of the story. But what I did in this case, you know, was just to report exactly what I saw. So, you know, everyone I saw in a cave eating leaves, I saw with my own eyes, and I reported that. And I made it very clear that I was traveling with the rebels. But, you know, the other thing in this particular conflict is, I mean, yes, they're a rebel force, they've got guns, they're fighting, but look, if you ask me, it's pretty clear who the bad guys and the good guys are here.
Mm.
There isn't a lot of ambiguity. Omar Bashir has a more than 20-year history of killing people in the far-flung parts of his country, people who are not Arabs or not Muslims. And, you know, he's continuing doing that. This is a guy who's, you know, wanted for genocide, war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. He's a fugitive from international justice. You know, he's an international pariah. He's not even very popular, as far as I can tell, in his own country anymore. So, you know, in this particular case, I feel like I was, you know, with the good guys.
There's a sort of a pact, if you will, that journalists make in this sort of situation when they talk to people who, you know, let's say in this situation are living in caves and eating leaves, and you ask them to tell you their story. And your promise to them is that you will get their story out to the wider world, and that might in some way make a difference. People will know what's going on. Do you feel that pact still exists? Do you worry that, you know, you go to a place like this, you report on what's going on, but still nothing necessarily happens?
Yeah, sort of screaming in space kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, I don't feel it's dishonest to tell people that's what you're doing, because, you know, that is what I did. I've written the story as in as many different places, in many different ways as I can. I've spoken as much as I can about it. But ultimately, it's not, you know, my decision whether aid gets in. It's the decision of, firstly, President Omar al-Bashir, who is refusing to allow any aid to go into the country, which means the only you know, foreign aid that's getting in is being snuck illegally over the border, and really is a drop in the ocean. It's just not enough. But it's also down to, you know, that thing we call the international community, which in this case means, you know, the guys on the Security Council. It means the big UN agencies, World Food Programme and others, who need to bring the pressure to, you know, to stop the fighting and allow the humanitarian workers to get in, because they're desperately needed there. But, you know, the thing that I also took away from this was that it's, you know, the rains are about to start. And when the rains come in Sudan, as you know, Steve, no one moves. So within a couple of weeks, all of the only road that you can get in on will disappear. The rest of the landscape will turn to this kind of sea of mud, and it will be impossible to move anything in or out until October. And I just don't know how these people are going to survive until October, let alone beyond that. But I felt very strongly that not only is the international community not doing enough to help the civilians in the New Mountains, but it's actually too late now. You know, it's too late to get them the food they need. It's too late to get them the protection they need. and they're going to be on their own now until October. And that was just an incredibly kind of depressing thing to take away with me, was that, yeah, I'd gone there to try and see what was going on and try and report it, but I was too late, and the international community is too late, and these people are on their own. And that's not to say they're helpless, but, you know, they're on their own, and we should be doing something for them.
What happens then in those coming months, you know, when the rains come, when aid can't get in, you know, even if it was allowed in, when journalists can't get in? How do you, as a journalist, approach telling that story?
Well, obviously, I now have, you know, some contacts in the Nuba Mountains who I can talk to and get information from on what's going on. But I think the way that we're going to, if we're going to continue to report this story, which I hope we all will, we're going to go to the refugee camp that is emerging on the border with South Sudan. Because when I say nothing can get in or out, I mean trucks and helicopters, you know, things carrying food. People can still walk through the mud. It'll take them a lot longer. It's been taking about 3 to 7 days for people to walk there. At the moment, it'll take more like 10 days to walk there in the rainy season. But the refugees will continue to come. And they will come, and you know, hungrier and sicker. Because when the rains come, the food is running out. But with the rains comes malaria, comes cholera, all these other diseases. And when you add that on top of malnutrition, then you start seeing people die. So what we're going to see is you know, hungrier, more desperate people coming on foot in greater numbers to the refugee camp in South Sudan. And then that's going to be, you know, a fresh challenge for the aid agencies to actually look after them there.
Tristan McConnell in Nairobi, just back from Sudan's Nuba Mountains. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers and politicians changing the urban world. On this episode of The Urbanist, we reverse our commute and head out to the suburbs. From Sydney's sprawl to the city of Surrey's new CBD, we look at the good, the bad and the brand new of living on the outskirts. And let's not forget the leafy and lofty 20th century ideals of London's Hampstead Garden suburb.
This would be very, very useful if you were in a guerrilla war, because it feels very secret, very enclosed, but the residents keep the hedges very well trimmed.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. Do you fancy a bit of Spanish electropop? Good. This is La Mano en el Fuego by Fangoria.
Si te sigo el juego, me quemo siempre por ti. He renunciado al cielo, me arrastro por el suelo. La mano.
That was La Mano en el Fuego by Fangoria. We're going to be talking about something rather exciting discovery right after this. It was announced this week that an international team of archaeologists have discovered evidence of a long-forgotten language during the excavation of a Assyrian palace in southeast Turkey. The surprising find came as one team member was deciphering an ancient clay writing tablet. That team member, Dr. John McGuinness of Cambridge University, joins us now on the line. Dr. McGuinness, welcome to Midori House. Congratulations. Can you tell us a bit more about the significance of this discovery?
Well, it's an absolutely tremendous discovery. So we have been excavating on this Assyrian provincial palace for about 10 years now, but we made this discovery 2 years ago, and it's taken that long to decipher and have it published.
Wow.
But to put it in context, the Assyrian Empire was the largest world empire of its day. So we're talking 9th to 7th century BC, and it ruled most of what we now consider the Middle East.
And you say, you know, you've been working on this, or the team has been working on this for 10 years, and this specific finding for 2 years. When it was first discovered 2 years ago, did you have an inkling of what it might be, or has it only been really recently that you've started to realise that actually this was something quite significant?
Well, it was immediately clear it was going to be an important find. So it's a large tablet, about the size of a paperback novel, and fortunately it was burnt in the destruction of the palace, and that's good for clay tablets. It actually helps preserve them. With unbaked clay, they rapidly deteriorate.
Okay.
So we could see it was a large tablet, and that was very good news. And then we started working on it, and we could see it was a list of names, and we can come back to that in a second, why we knew that.
Mm.
But it took a while for it to emerge just how important this tablet was going to be.
I want to sort of step back a moment, if that's okay. You say the team's been working on this for 10 years. How many people are involved in the process for a dig like this, and how does it all work?
But this is actually a major excavation, and it's an international collaboration. It's in front of a dam being built, which we can talk about later if there's time. But there's an overall director from America, from the University of Akron, Ohio, Professor Matney. Then there's my team from Cambridge, a team from Germany under Dirk Vicker, and then a team from Turkey as well.
And you've all been working on it for that period of time?
We've all been working on the site, that's right. So it tends to be 25 to 30 specialists from Turkey and from the West. And then depending on our objectives for the year, we employ something around 40 to 50 workmen.
And do you get excited by these sorts of discoveries? Or do you find that actually, you know, whatever it is you're finding, whatever it is you're looking into is still quite exciting anyway?
Oh, definitely find it exciting. I mean, archaeology is a great profession to be in. You get up in the morning and you absolutely have no idea what you're going to be finding. It's very exciting anyway. But when you come across an object like this, it really makes you think that you're holding an object which no one has held for over 2,500 years, and you're reading a text which no one has read for over 2,500 years.
Well, let's talk specifically about that text. As you say, there were 45 names on this tablet which were unclear as to who they were and what language it was in. Talk us through the process of you know, going from discovering the clay tablet in the first place to being where we are right now.
Well, discovering the clay tablet, that's quite interesting. So I say it was found on this palace floor and had been burnt. It was in a very fragmentary condition, but the conservators have a very clever way of spraying material over it, which solidifies it so they can move the tablet to the laboratory. And then over the next 2 or 3 days, this material evaporates completely so you can read it. There were actually about 60 names, and one or two of those are actually Assyrian names, and one or two belong to languages that we know of. But it then became clear that the remaining, it's at least 45, it's probably more than 45, but the remaining names did not belong to any known language.
And so then what happens next when you realise that these don't belong to any known language? How do you work out what language it might be?
Good. So I'd ask your listeners to visualise a map of the Middle East with Iraq and Syria. The Assyrian Empire covered the whole of Iraq and Syria, and it also covered adjoining bits of all the adjoining countries. Now, if we start in the south, the south of Iraq, the ancient languages were Babylonian, Elamite, and then to the west, Arabic, and these names don't belong to those languages. The Assyrians actually invaded Egypt on 3 occasions, but the names are not Egyptian. Going up the west along the east coast of the Mediterranean, you have Hebrew and Aramaic, which are Semitic languages. Again, they're not those. And then in the north, you have a language called Hurrian, again excluded. So as you can imagine, this leaves the east, and it makes a lot of sense that these names come from the east. We know the Assyrians invaded the east, and these people probably came from that area.
And so is it simply a case of, you know, sort of a trial by error, you know, working out, you know, which ones it's not, and then, well, it must be something in this region here?
There is something in that. It is a process of deduction, but it does make excellent sense. We know that the Assyrians, when they invaded countries and created their huge empire, they then deported large numbers of people from the newly conquered territory and moved them to another region. And the reason for doing that was to break up the society, make it easier to rule. And we know of two kings in particular, Tiglath-Pileser III and Sargon II, who invaded what we now consider Western Iran and deported people to other parts of their empire.
So talk us through what happens next. Obviously, this is a long, the excavation itself is obviously still ongoing. I assume you have quite a while left on that. Is there any more work to be done on this language itself?
Well, there's work on both fronts, as you suggest. As far as the excavation goes, we actually only have 2 more years of excavation. It's the kind of site where you could work for decades more, but our permit is only for 2 more years, and then we'll see what happens. As far as the language goes, the next step is, first of all, to compare these names to place names that we know from other Assyrian inscriptions to see if there's any match there. Then, of course, to continue our work at Zira Tepe. And lastly, and this may be looking somewhat further ahead, one day there will be renewed archaeological exploration in Western Iran, and perhaps that will find more concrete evidence of the Assyrian presence there.
Well, good luck with all of that. Dr. John McGuinness of Cambridge University, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. Now, Olympic fever has fully descended upon Monocle's home turf of London. And earlier today, Monocle 24's Adrian Craddock was given the opportunity to get a first-hand look at the star attraction at the Olympic Park, London's newest landmark, The Orbit. Amid gusty winds and crowds of reporters, Adrian bumped into London's mayor, Boris Johnson. He asked what comparisons could be drawn between The Orbit and that iconic monument of sporting games past, the Eiffel Tower.
This is obviously a thing of the 21st century. It's a much more sophisticated structure. It's a totally absorbing thing to look at. I think people who come here and look at it close to really will find their eye absorbed by the way that the shapes change as you walk around it. It's a remarkable piece of engineering that I don't think would have been possible in the 19th century.
And what does it mean to the City of London?
This is it's a statement of economic confidence in London, in the Stratford site. It's our way of saying that London is welcoming the world, it's beckoning the world to London in 2012 for the summer. But it's also, even more important, it's a great work of art, but it is there to serve as a pole of attraction, as something that people are going to want to bring their kids up to look around, to enjoy for a long time to come. And that is all part of our strategy to make sure that the Olympics deliver long-term benefits for this part of London. There's no point in putting £9.3 billion into the Olympic Games if people don't keep coming, don't keep finding a reason to want to come and visit this site. So that was why we needed to do it.
That was Adrian Craddock talking to London's Mayor Boris Johnson. And you can hear more of Adrian's report, including interviews with Cecil Bowman and Anish Kapoor, the brains behind The Orbit, on next week's Section D, which premieres on Tuesday at 1900 hours London time. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be going for some coffee, we'll be heading to Milan, and I think we're also going to be drinking some gin with Santiago, judging by what he's just brought into the studio. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Steve. Greek President Karolos Papoulias received the outgoing Prime Minister Loukas Papademos today in his presidential palace for an urgent briefing on the state of the country. The brother of one of the victims of the Norwegian mass killer Anders Behring Breivik threw a shoe at him in court today. It's the first time the trial has been interrupted by a public outburst. Activists have said Syrian government forces fired on anti-regime protesters in Damascus today. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that 5 civilians were wounded. The European Union's foreign policy chief said today she hoped upcoming talks with Iran would form the basis for Tehran to eventually abandon its alleged nuclear weapons project. Pirates have hijacked a Greek-owned oil tanker carrying 135,000 metric tons of crude oil while in the Arabian Sea, the first successful attack on an oil tanker off the Horn of Africa in more than a year. After 5 years of rising deaths, civilian casualties in Afghanistan dropped 20% in the first 4 months of the year, the United Nations said. A rare piece of good news as foreign combat forces prepare to pull out by the end of 2014. Médecins Sans Frontières has decried a lack of action by Nigeria's government to tackle a lead poisoning epidemic that has killed 400 children and poisoned 10 times as many near a gold mine. And in Britain, Rebecca Brooks, former editor of the News of the World newspaper, has told an inquiry that Prime Minister David Cameron was among top British politicians who sent her sympathetic messages when she was forced to resign. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelly. It's time now for us to check in with Santiago Tarditi, because it's Friday. We're going to have a look at the edits section, not of the magazine, but of the edit section of life. Is that a way of looking at it?
The edit section of life,
yes,
yeah.
Why not? Why not? You're going to talk us through a couple of things that have been that have caught your eye this week, including one thing which I've mentioned already, which certainly caught my eye when you wandered into the studio with it, which is a bottle of gin. But do you want to talk about what else you've got in front of you first?
Yeah, well, before we open the bottle of gin, I wanted to talk about an article I read earlier this week, because this Spanish think tank, food think tank, mm-hmm. called Asti Tecnalia, just released what they think are going to be the 2020 consumer food trends. So the trends of the future.
Okay, the sort of things we're going to be eating in what, 8 years' time?
Yeah, and what's going to shape the culinary scene somehow. So one of the things they mention is the eatertainment. So this, of course...
I see what they've done there.
Yeah. So this, of course, means that you're not just going to go to a restaurant and sit at a table and just have the regular experience, but rather... you will be in an environment that leaves you with more memories than just food. That's one of the things I hate about eating. Is just every time you eat, you forget the flavor like 10 seconds after you swallow it. But if you have like a whole experience, if you have good music, or if you had a particular bottle of wine, or even a particular waiter that made your night special, that's going to leave a mark.
It's those sorts of things that do. It's when the entertainment is sort of... not forced, but it's you have to eat and be entertained at the same time.
This isn't like live can while you
exactly. It's
while
not
you're
that sort
eating
of thing.
Like in a samovar or something like that. No. This is more for to give you an example. Last year I went to a great pop up restaurant organized by Bomba Sempar at this Masonic temple in the Andes Hotel. I mean, how many nice. Times can you dine at a Masonic temple in a hotel in East London or anywhere?
Not that often, I imagine. No.
So, I mean, it's something that I can't even remember what they served, but
but you remember the experience.
Yeah, it was such a great experience. So that's entertainment.
Okay. I think they need to work on the name, but fine. we get the concept.
Well, wait till you hear the other ones, because they also have a Super Sense. This relates to multi-sensory experiences. So this is food that involves all the senses. So you'll see people eating more with their hands rather than cutlery. Food will have a nicer presentation. Lots of colors, lots of sauces, it's not just going to be like a piece of red steak and the white potato. This is going to have a lot of different colors and flavors, and of course textures as well, to involve the hearing. Is also a part of their foretelling. And what's also, I think that on after doing a bit of research, I think that what's also going to be very, very important is food for people over 65 years of age. Because right now, 2/3 of people who live in over 65 are alive today.
So that makes sense.
Basically,
yep.
Food for older people.
Well, and also I guess we've got a generation now, you know, that are either 65 or approaching 65, who have, you know, who've got perhaps a bit more money than the generation before had of that age, and also have experienced perhaps better food as well, and are more used to. To the finer.
But I think that at 65, well, I'll tell you when I get there, but I don't think you'll take like nonsense. I mean, you're not up for nonsense anymore. So a foam or like some spherification is not really going to be attractive. So I think chefs will start thinking about going back to roots, making again simple food that is very light, because of course you don't want to upset a 65-year-old stomach or something.
You said I don't want to do that.
But it's going to be food that is going to be still very, very hearty, full of nutrients. And that's where, for example, the superfood comes in, food that is being discovered or used in the kitchen these days, like, for example, lingonberries or mangosteen or these foods that are very, very high in antioxidants and nutrients and so on.
So from casting our minds forwards to the year 2020, let's bring it back to the present day and talk about that thing you've got in front of you there.
That thing is a bottle.
And it's quite a classy looking bottle as well.
Yeah, this is Gilpin's, an extra dry gin, limited edition, small batch produced here in London. It's produced by Matthew Gilpin with the help of master distiller Charles Maxwell. It's made with eight different botanicals, and it is being sold right now at the Dorchester and the Duke's Bar here in London.
Excellent.
So, I mean, without much further ado, I think.
I think we need a little bit of a tasting. I mean, have you tried this before?
Nice. No, actually, no. Yeah. Oh, so it has a beautiful cork cap, and let me pour you a little bit here.
That's very good sound effects. We like that.
I can't pour you like a long shot.
Because no, you can't.
I know you still have a bit too.
I still have the rest of the show. Are you going to have some yourself as well?
Yeah, I will. Why not?
It would be rude for me to drink in front of you.
So, of course, this reminds me a bit of my show, Santiago's Basket, where we try things with Marcus Hippie.
Well, in fact, you know, it's good that you mentioned that because we're going to hear your basket in about 20 minutes or so. The menu follows right after this.
Mm. Delicious.
It is actually, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. One of the first flavors you get is the Spanish orange peel, a bit of lemon peel also. The lemon peel comes from Italy, for example, and of course the main ingredient in all gins, the juniper berry that comes from Bulgaria.
From Bulgaria?
Yep.
Wow.
You like it?
I do, yeah. That's really good.
I'll see if I can find some tonic.
Yeah, we need a little bit of tonic.
Fever Tree or Fentimans.
A nice fresh lime. And we'll be away, a little bit of ice. Santiago, thank you very much for coming in with your gin. You can leave the bottle there, that's fine. We'll look after it. We're going to be back with a song right after this. You're listening to Midori House.
The Entrepreneurs is about finding the human face of successful businesses, meeting the men and women at the helm of enterprises with staying power, and handpicking the ideas that really matter amongst the hubbub. From international tech firms to setting up shop in your local community, we cover people-centred businesses, big and small, and gather a few pointers on how to strike out on your own along the way from the people who really know about self-started success.
Get big or die trying.
On the latest edition, we'll be looking at an unlikely new force in fashion. That's a British-based denim manufacturing brand that's attempting to wrestle back market share from the Americans and Japanese. We'll also be speaking to one of the young founders of Mixcloud, a site that's gaining traction as a quality way to listen to music online.
We have the technical infrastructure up and ready, and we have a growing sizable audience now of over 3 million listeners a month.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet. Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
And if anyone's wondering, Danny Giacopelli, our producer here on Midori House today, who's also the producer of The Entrepreneurs, is going to produce some T-shirts with the slogan, Get Big or Die Trying. But first of all, here's a song. This is Fast by Ola Onabuli. That was Fast by Ola Onabuli. You're listening to Midori House. And you're listening to Midori House. It is 18:45 here in London. A hotel proprietor in northern Italy has accidentally become mayor of a small town earlier this week, despite not even intending to run for election. Fabio Borsati, who's 50 years old, added himself to the mayoral ballot as a last-minute favour to the man actually hoping to become mayor, his friend Gino Bartolo. Now, to discuss this and maybe a couple of other stories that are piquing his interest in the Italian media this week, we're joined by our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, welcome to Midori House.
Good evening, Steve.
Tell us more about Mr. Bossati and how he became mayor.
Yeah, in this, there were these administrative elections over the weekend for various mayoral races in Italy. And this caught everybody's attention because it's, as you explained, it's quite a funny story because Fabio Rosati was doing this as a favor. And his whole family actually voted for his friend, and he was off. He didn't even bother to vote. And then discovered while he was preparing for celebrations for Juventus, he's a Juventus fan, and they just won the Italian Football League. And he got called and said, oh, you're now mayor. And so he decided, well, people did vote for me, so I guess I have to follow the will of the people. And he's now going
so he's
to...
Now mayor. So Ivan, tell me, why did his friend Gino Bartolo, why did he ask Fabio to stand for mayor? I mean, what was okay. What was the reason behind
right.
it?
The thing is that they needed a quorum so that they would have enough people voting because his friend was worried because there was nobody running against him. So he wanted to have this because if there's no quorum reached in terms of a minimum number of voters, what can happen is that the state can come in and set up and bring someone from the central government to run it because a quorum wasn't reached. And that usually happens, for example, in southern Italy when there are, say, towns that have problems with organized crime and the yeah. central state has to move in. So this is quite funny because Borsati actually doesn't – he owns a hotel in another town, but now he's going to try to promote tourism in this town, he says.
Brilliant. And here's the key question. Are Fabio and Gino still friends? Has Gino forgiven him for taking his mayoralty away from him?
Right now, there's a lot of stories about a falling out because at the moment, Fabio doesn't want to make Gino his vice mayor. So this will be a story that I'm sure the regional media there will be following intently for the next couple of months. But it's a sign of, obviously, some funny things have been going on in these latest elections because the center-right party of Berlusconi and his former ally, the Northern League, they got decimated. I mean, these are administrative elections. They're not for parliament yet. But voters were unhappy, and they went with movements like Beppe Grillo, who's this comedian blogger who's very popular in Italy. His website is one of the most followed in Italy, if not one of the top maybe 100 sites in the world, I think. And he doesn't want candidates to take, money because the big problem now is with these scandals recently in Italy, party financing, and they have made some progress. I have to say that they've reduced the number of reimbursements to political parties in the last election. They saved about 90 million euros. It's not a lot, but when you have a 1.9 trillion debt, but it's something.
It's something.
And they're going to lower the ceiling, they say, next year for how much parties can take from the state because party financing, public financing is so important in Italy, at least for now.
I mean, is there a sense that, with Italian politics generally, that voters don't really know where to turn? That, Berlusconi went last year, went earlier, but, who really is there to replace him on the left? Who really is there to replace him on the right as a sensible centre-right figure? Do you get the sense that voters are casting around for proper politicians they feel they can trust and coming up with no one?
Yeah, at the moment, there's not a lot of options. There have been recently some stories about, in a poll that was taken, that Luca de Montezemolo, who runs Ferrari and is a shareholder in this new private train service, high-speed trains that are now running in Italy the last couple of weeks. And there was talk that he got 24% in this poll, and there was some voices about maybe he could align with the center-right. And so maybe be someone next year comes the spring, because Mario Monti has said that he will try to fill out this mandate that was given to him as a technocratic government to help fix the finances and maybe spur growth. So there might be somebody there. It's very strange right now because it feels like there are some sort of the tectonic plates, as I mentioned the other day on the Globalist, talking with your colleagues. It really, in a year's time, you could see a new movement develop and be running against the center-left, which have always had problems, getting a leader, and they tend to fumble the ball the last yards before, and so that could be something that we'll have to look forward to.
Well, I don't know whether look forward to is perhaps the right phrase, but yes, something that will be coming up. Let's look a little bit at the centre-left in Italy. I mean, who are their key players at the moment? Is there anyone that can really sort of bring them together?
Well, Matteo Renzi, the mayor of Florence, voted Italy's most popular mayor. Has done a lot of initiatives to make Florence not just that tourist attraction that everybody knows, but also to raise the quality of life in that city. And he's thrown his hat in the ring sort of a bit vaguely, because he's organized a movement in the past to say that there needs to be generational change in Italy, because we have all these leaders and these parties, and they're always there, and even after an election, they're still there, whether it's Berlusconi or Umberto Bossi of the Lega Nord. Whether they lose or win, you know, we need to have maybe the under 40s come in and take the reins. And you know, he's a very young, dynamic guy, and he doesn't speak this political ease as many Italian politicians are well versed in. But it's still early because there was talk about an October election, but I think right now people are more worried about getting through the summer. So we'll have to see.
And one final thing, I mean, obviously, you know, Mario Monti is seen as a safe pair of hands, certainly outside Italy. He's probably sort of fairly popular amongst those outside Italy who are politically interested and involved. How is he seen inside Italy at the moment? Are people all sort of fairly content with how he's been doing?
Well, he still has fairly good approval ratings. Obviously, there's a big pinch on people's pocketbooks because of taxes that have been raised. You know, gas prices are about $10 a gallon. Various other measures that have been taken, property tax, for example, which has drove a lot of people mad. Despite that, he still has a sort of a broad support. Not as much, obviously, has in European circles. It's not an easy task because he's had to come in and, as he said, clean up from the last 20 years when there was short-term political thinking, and a lot of these leaders previously didn't address the debt problem, which is now 120% of Italy's GDP, and growth is still this mysterious beast that no one can get their hands on and try to grow the Italian economy. So
no, indeed.
It's not obviously a job that anybody would want right now, but he seems to be steering the ship fairly straight at the moment.
Yeah, not an easy job, but I imagine the pay and the perks aren't bad. Ivan Carvalho, Monocle's man in Milan, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Now, every week on Midori House, we like to speak to one of our neighbours to get to know some of our rather special local businesses that we have here in Marylebone in London. And this week, we headed to The Workshop, an independent coffee house fueling office workers and others right in the heart of Marylebone.
Hi, I'm Tom. I am a barista at Workshop Coffee Company in Marylebone. It used to be called Sensory Lab. We changed the name just over 3 weeks ago. We basically had a partnership with a company in Australia with the same name, but due to the long distance between Australia and England, it was difficult to maintain that relationship, so we opted for a bit of distinction, and we've struck out on our own path. We've always had a lot of Australian customers. I think partly, possibly, the brand had something to do with it, but also because I think Australians think of coffee as, I think, probably quite sacred. So when they travel overseas, they're pretty proud of where they come from in terms of that coffee culture. So they like to seek out good coffee when they move around. And now that there's a wealth of good coffee in London, you get them everywhere, myself included. I like to think we offer a really personal service. Our bar is designed such that there's very little barrier between the staff and the customers. It's a very low bar. It's very uncluttered. Apart from the espresso machine, there isn't a lot in between the customers and the staff. I think that kind of personal service goes a really long way. When you come in and order filter coffee, you can have that one-on-one experience with the barista, who can answer any questions you have about the coffee. You can learn more about the different coffees we have and how we source them, how we roast them.
If you want to get a really nice, simple pattern on top, then you want it to be as smooth as possible and really dense.
Yeah, we have a lot of regular customers. I'd say the majority of our customer base are regulars. People who work in the area, people who are local to it, people who live in the area, definitely have a lot of regulars. We get a lot of business people. Probably not too many tourists, being just off Oxford Street. We probably miss out on a bit of the tourist trade. We roast all our own coffee in our other store in Clerkenwell. So we do our own espresso blends. We currently have three different filter coffees, two from Rwanda, one from Bolivia. And it's a seasonal product, so they do change from time to time, every 2 to 3 months or so. Currently, I am a big fan of the Buff Cafe, the Rwandan, which we are offering as a single origin filter coffee, but it also makes up part of our espresso blends. It's absolutely delicious. Well, obviously, our espresso is very popular, but the filter coffees are really catching on. It's coffee shops offering high-quality filter coffee. It hasn't been around for that long. It's starting to gain popularity, and certainly I noticed it here. It was a little slow at first. People weren't so receptive to it, I guess. But the longer we've been open, we've certainly increased our filter coffee trade a lot. I think people are starting to realise that there is a really good alternative to chain coffee shops. Certainly, I'm confident in saying that we offer a really good quality product, and people are really, especially in the UK now, it's really kind of booming. Lots of new places opening up all the time, so I think people are becoming more aware of the good coffee that's coming to the UK. The people who work for us, they're very passionate about the coffee industry. They're passionate about coffee, so they like to get to know everything they possibly can about it, I guess. It's nice to have that background knowledge behind the coffee, so it helps you influence your decisions when brewing the coffee, when selecting coffees, when talking to the customer about these coffees. It definitely helps. I'm going to make you a lovely cappuccino. I'm going to pull a double espresso for you. We serve these in 6 ounce cups, so you're going to have about 30 grams of espresso, and the rest of it will be lovely velvety textured milk. I'm weighing the espresso. Basically, we want to brew to a ratio so that we start with a certain amount of dry coffee and we want to extract a certain amount of espresso from that. It's a ratio of about 1.5 that we work with. I want to extract about 28.5-29 grams of espresso. I think it's a really nice spot that we've got here on the intersection of Wigmore and James Street. Plenty of exposure, so yeah, it's lovely.
And those were the lovely proprietors at the Workshop Coffee House in Marylebone here in London. See, we've given you coffee and we've given you gin. How's that for a Friday evening here in London at Choose Your Poison? I'm afraid that's all for today's Midori. Thank you very much for tuning in. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Ben Jay, studio manager was Sam Impey. The news is next, then you've got the menu, so more food and drink, and of course there's a daily at 2200 hours London time. But for now, thank you very much for listening. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.